Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica, producido por Cuonda.
En el trabajo hay mucho esfuerzo y tiene que merecer la pena. Si tienes una pasión por algo, debes seguirla. Todo es más sencillo. Eso fue lo que hizo desde bien joven el fotógrafo americano Steve McCurry. Es una de las leyendas de este arte y hoy es el protagonista de Encuentros, el podcast del espacio Fundación Telefónica. ¡Arrancamos! Son más de 30 años dedicados en cuerpo y alma al mundo de la fotografía. Cámara en mano, Steve McCurry ha recorrido el mundo entero retratando la realidad de los países y las gentes que encontraba a su paso. Su relación de amor con la fotografía empezó después de su etapa en el instituto. Encontré, dice, en la fotografía la posibilidad de no tener que meterme en una oficina cada día para ganarme la vida. La semilla de la fotografía germinó poco a poco en mí. Viajó por India, Afganistán, Sri Lanka, Filipinas, llegó a cubrir incluso conflictos armados y tocó el cielo gracias a los ojos de una niña a la que volvió a buscar y a encontrar después de 17 años. Gracias a Leica, Steve McCurry visita el auditorio del espacio Fundación Telefónica para repasar su carrera, hacer balance y contarnos hacia dónde se dirige ahora su carrera. Viajo más que en toda mi vida, pero es la primera vez que me siento asentado con un hogar. Mi hija ha influido muchísimo en esto. McCurry, de la mano de Karin Ren Kaufman, directora internacional de Leica Galleries, analiza además varias de sus imágenes más icónicas y nos las enmarca con palabras para que tu imaginación las dibuje. Un ejercicio realmente bello. ¡Que disfrutéis!
Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica.
Very warm welcome. Hola. Buenos días. No, it's okay. Buenos días. Gracias for coming in such a crowd here. Sorry, I can't turn around all the time. So it's my second time here to stay on the stage because I remember we had these Eyes Wide Open 100 years of Leica photography in 2017. And it was a real success here in this wonderful space. So I'm very honored to have the possibility to be here again, combined with this wonderful event that we have tonight, that we opened our 25th Leica gallery around the world here in Madrid. And that means that Leica really took in the past, and we still take care of the culture of photography, of the quality of photography in the past, today, and hopefully also tomorrow. With this 25 Leica galleries, we give photographers the possibility and the platform to show their work and to tell their moving stories. But beside this, we have our Leica Hall of Fame Award. And Steve, I'm glad, happy and proud that we have you here today for the opening of Madrid. And he got for the first time this Leica Hall of Fame Award that was in 2011 during St. Moritz Art Masters. And we give this outstanding prize for iconic photographers for their life work. So we have also like Bruce Davidson, René Bury, and a lot of others. And also beside this, we have our Leica Oscar Barnack Award, one of the most important photography awards in the world. Since 40 years now, we have our birthday next year. And this is also something that when you look at the persons, the photographers who won the prize, that after they won it, they really are on another level because we give them the possibilities to show their work in the Leica galleries, also sometimes in fairs. And we have our Leica Photography International magazine where we also, of course, publish their work. Only to mention one name, Sebastião Salgado won the prize twice. So that means something. So, and I could go on and on to tell you what Leica is really investing in the culture of photography. And the last thing before we start, I want to mention that we have worldwide the first really experience center for photography on different levels at our Leica headquarters in Wetzlar. We have there, of course, we have our company there. You can see how the Leica lenses are produced. We have there a hotel. We have there a museum, different, on different levels. We have downstairs, we have the print museum. And I hope to be able to exhibit also one day your work, Steve. And on the second level, we will tell and more the experience around the lenses, around Leica, with the feeling of touch and feel, but also, of course, the history of Leica. And then we have a coffee, a nice little coffee house there with a Leica cake. And so you really can, and we have a Leica gallery there as well. So a lot of things to experience. So we would be more than honored when you are interested to visit the Leica headquarters. It's just near Frankfurt, near the Frankfurt airport. So it's 45 minutes to drive. So once again, a very warm welcome. And now I start with my dear Steve. So before we will look in all these wonderful different pictures, I would like to ask you one question. Was there a special reason, or why you really dedicated your life, your soul, your passion for photography? Why?
Well, I started traveling when I was 19. I actually lived in Europe for a year. And this was after high school. And I thought, you know, what can I do with my life? How can I avoid getting a job and having to actually work for a living? So I met somebody in Sweden, a couple people in Amsterdam. And the seed of photography was kind of planted at that time. I went back to school, didn't know what I wanted to do, and I thought, well, maybe filmmaking would be fun.
Yeah, I remember, of course, yes. You studied film at the Pennsylvania State right. University, right.
But that, as I was in that program, it seemed like a lot of work, because filmmaking is much more difficult than still photography, in that you have post-production, pre-production, you have, you know, sound people, and it's very involved. But while I was studying film, I took a class in still photography, and then it kind of clicked that, you know, here was something I could do by myself, literally walk out the door of my home or the hotel and actually photograph without a script, without any, really, everything was more spontaneous. So I thought, well, this sounds promising. And I got a job in a newspaper for a year or so. And then I thought, well, let me get back to my first love, which was travel. So I saved some money, went to India. And I just...
When did you first, because India, I mean, I don't know how often you traveled to India, when it was the first time? Because, I mean, normally you only traveled with a little bag, with some clothes inside to be really flexible, and then, of course, with your film rolls. When was the first time visited India?
It was actually early in 1978. I went with, I think I had 200 rolls of Kodachrome in a suitcase. And I just traveled around the country. I hadn't really, probably up at that point, I had shot maybe 20 rolls of color in my life. So I was new to color. It was really difficult photographing and not seeing your work, because everything had to be sent back to be processed at Kodak. So, you know, I couldn't see my pictures. I wasn't that familiar with color. But I spent 2 years, 2 years traveling around, sending the pictures.
So that means you stayed 2 years in India.
2 years in India.
For the first time, you just stayed there.
Yeah,
for...
but also in that 2 years, I went to Afghanistan. And that's when, at that point, I was kind of had run out of color film, and I bought some I had a few roles. I bought some black and white film in Delhi, New Delhi, and then took that film to in Afghanistan. So the first pictures in Afghanistan were primarily black and white. So that kind of, and based on the success of that first trip to Afghanistan, when I sent the film back, my sister was able to get the pictures placed in a magazine and newspapers.
I think she's always, is she still working in the back, also responsible for the book publishing?
Yeah, she's kind of my CEO.
Agency, CEO.
She's kind of my consigliere, and she's my boss, and my she does everything.
She's everything, okay.
That was kind of my, I would say my big break after almost 2 years was this Afghanistan trip. And from that, I was able to start getting assignments. Because up until then, everything was, I was paying for everything. And eventually I was able to get a couple assignments just to kind of...
So, but coming back to my question, so that means because you said, okay, I don't want to have any normal job. Mm. I like to travel. I like to take pictures. So you made your passion as a profession.
Yeah, I think that...
Great.
You know, if you can find something in life which you love, then it's fun.
Don't leave it.
It's always work, and there's a lot of effort in the sense that, I mean, everything you do that's worthwhile in life requires a lot of effort. But if you have a passion for something, then, you know, follow that. And so I felt really fortunate that I was able to continue with the photography and just kind of like make a whole career out of it up until today. I'm still working. People often say, well, are you still shooting? And it's like I'm actually working as much now. I'm traveling more now than I ever have in my entire life.
So this is a question I wanted to ask you. I mean, when I look backwards, the last month, when I look forwards, we just were talking about, because Steve is traveling for the next days, like tomorrow at 7 to Singapore, then the day after to Shanghai, then Tokyo, Kyoto, and so on. So, and this is, I mean, traveling is your life. Where do you feel at home?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I've lived in New York for 35 years, but I'm recently, my wife and I have recently had a daughter, so we've actually living in Tucson, Arizona now. So that's, I would say that's really my home now, but we're going to be moving to Pennsylvania for, because my studio's there, but I would say right now, I would say Tucson, Arizona. We have a house and, the whole thing, you know, so it's the first time in my life I really feel grounded, and I can't tell you how satisfying it is to have that kind of normal life for once.
Is it because of your child that you the first time feel at home?
Yeah, I had it's like I've lived out of a suitcase for so many years, and my apartment in New York has been more like a kind of a hotel transit. and New York is I love New York, but I don't really feel like a New Yorker, because I get there, I go from my apartment to my studio and then back to my apartment, and I have friends and all that there, but it just feels like another place that I'm sort of traveling through. So I feel Tucson's kind of more family, feel more kind of anchored there. So I'm couldn't be happier right now.
So perhaps we start now. I mean, we will see this picture later on also, because of course there are a lot of stories from Steve about this Afghanistan girl. Okay. Oh, but this is not the first picture, sorry. Voila. The technique. Wow. Okay, thank you. So, Steve, this is a very important picture for you because, as I learned, this is the cover of your latest book. I mean, how many books you published? About a dozen or more?
I think it's 15. This is the my current book, the one that just came out a few weeks ago, is on animals, and it's published by Passion, if anybody wants to. This was the last book from last year, which... it's kind of a biography.
So a retrospective?
Yeah, it's kind of a retrospective. My sister kind of edited the book. This was the cover.
And why did you use that as a cover?
I thought, first of all, it's a portrait, which I love portraits. I think that kind of represents my work. I love the color. I don't really think of myself as a color photographer, but I do think in this case the color works.
I mean, I think it's really because the older woman is really looking at you, and this is always good for a book cover, I think, when somebody is looking at you.
Yeah. The thing which I've always loved about this picture is, everything's red, but even her thumb is painted with red nail polish. I always thought that was kind of a funny, in the scheme of the picture. I spent about 4 months on the train in India doing a story back in 1984, going from basically Pakistan through India to Bangladesh on the train.
So this is also an experience, I can imagine, during these times, especially.
It was, because especially at that time, that's the way everybody traveled in India, was by train. And, you would get on the train and... in Delhi, you'd spend 2 days to get to Madras. And in the meantime, you're meeting all these people, and people are coming and going. So it's a great way to meet people. But also the train station itself was full of people, cows and chickens and goats and people living there and washing and sleeping and everything. It was like a little microcosm of, Indian society right there on the train station. So I teamed up with a friend of mine, a great writer named Paul Theroux, who had his book called the Great Railway Bazaar, inspired me to do this story. And then when I started photographing, we teamed up together and did this story. So I spent literally about 4 months going up and down the train, I think the best way to dig deep into a story is you need to invest time to, because otherwise you're always kind of on the surface. And
I think this is a really important sentence. Would you just take your time? Because nowadays everyone is shooting a lot of people are only shooting and not taking pictures. And I think this is a great difference, to have an idea in mind and then really to look what you photograph.
And working and whatnot, you start becoming, you realize I can do better. What satisfied me last week, I know there's more to dig, and so you keep raising the bar, you keep improving on what you're doing. In time, you start getting better, and you're less satisfied, you become more discerning, more careful. And I think all the photographic projects I've worked on in my life, they all, just spending time and honing it and working it and just saying, I know I can do better. Let me try this, let me try that. Because if you go to a place, I was in Cuba last week. If I was there another week, I could have spent even more time trying to just improve what I was doing.
That means you go several times to the places you were before, a second or a third time, because you have the feeling you missed something, or?
Well, in the case of Cuba, I've been there five times.
And I mean, really the same street or the same
house? Well, the same sort of neighborhood, so, yeah. But in India, I've been there like 80 times.
80 times.
So I go there and I, again, just kind of wander and explore. Once you get to know the place, you know, one thing leads to another, and doors open up, and kind of magically, mystically, things just start to happen.
So I think we, I don't know why this doesn't work. I learned to push, yeah. Okay. So there is something special on this picture. I don't know what it is, but I heard that there is a special emotion combined with this image.
Yeah, the thing which I loved about this picture was that when I first, this is in Yemen, this is already maybe 22 years ago, I saw these women in these hats, and I instantly knew that this was really interesting. It was, I mean, this is before, you know, Harry Potter and all that. I thought, but there was something about that hat which was, it really was, there was kind of a mystery about it or something. And so I decided to find and seek out these women when they were, I saw them walking down the street, but I thought, you know, I got to go and find out, I want to photograph them working. So I spent a few days, and I, you know, asked some questions, and eventually I was able to find the man who owned that field, and I explained what I was doing, and got permission to photograph the women, and so I just spent like two mornings and part of an afternoon photographing these women in the field, and I just, it was so unusual that I just became kind of obsessed with the idea of getting a picture which I thought was going to be really told that story of women, not only with the hat, but dressed entirely in black. And they even had black gloves on. I think it's part
of... So that means you only saw here...
Yeah, there's a... You can just see her nose.
Yeah.
And otherwise, they're completely covered, I guess, because of the Islamic tradition and the very conservative in that area. And I thought this is...
That they can work with a hat, that means normally you think the hat will fall down.
And the heat, because, I mean, Yemen is incredibly hot. So, yeah.
Come on.
Well, this is I did a story on the monsoon, again, a long time ago. And it was the case where I was working in a flooded area, and I thought, you know, how can I, you know, the water was so dirty, I better just work from a boat. This was another area. And then I thought, well, that's not going to work. I got some like boots that came up to here. And then I realized, because the water got into the boots, and eventually I realized that the only way to do this story was to actually get into the dirty water and do it the same way the people were surviving and living. So I got into the water. It was really dirty and nasty.
But that was in India.
This is India. Yeah, this is in Delhi. So I spent, again, another 3 or 4 months photographing the rain, you know, the
We will have some more pictures about the flood later.
These are just some, yeah.
This is also India.
No, this is Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So I think we go a little bit through, because otherwise we will sit until 10 o'clock when we talk about each picture so long, because we have a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
So perhaps also you can look at the pictures and tell me...
This is the Philippines.
This is amazing.
Well, you know, I was in the Philippines, and they have this system of rice terracing, and it's really amazing, and I actually... I hired a helicopter for 3 days, three full days, I hired the helicopter to fly me around this region. And the last day when we were going to fly back to Manila, it got very overcast, very cloudy, and the pilot couldn't fly back because it was no visibility. So I just walked up from my hotel. I walked up the road and just took some pictures right from the road. And this was one of those pictures, which turned out to be much better than the pictures from the helicopter, because here we're really close to the workers.
Look a bit closer, yeah.
And it turned out to be...
These are rice fields. Or what is it?
Yeah, the rice terrace, yeah.
So this is one of the most iconic also from you. When was it shot?
1996.
You really know each picture? So you have your own archive?
Yeah, always accessible. Well, you know, this is again, so it's 20-some years ago. I've seen so many people comment about this situation and that the way the world is going and the way Sri Lanka is going, a lot of the fishermen who used to actually do this for a living now have decided to join the tourist industry, whether drivers or cooks or working in hotels. But for tourists, they still will still do this.
Only for tourists.
Well, I think.
But during these times, I think that
when I was doing it, it was an authentic thing. I'm saying now, I think most of these fishermen are only doing it to be paid by tourists, you know, because you know this method of fishing now is. I don't know if they can make a living now the way, you know, the world's changed.
But it's an acrobatic act because, I mean, imagine sitting there and fishing.
Yeah, they would sit there for a couple hours in the morning and then they go back in the afternoon when the temperature of the water was favorable. But, it was really...
I think this is Peru again, the women here.
Well, that's Tibet.
Okay.
Tibet. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite place in the world, not only to photograph, but just to kind of be there, is Tibet, because it's the landscape is amazing. They have this incredible Buddhist culture, and it's just a place that I feel very connected to. This is a woman that lives in a tent, and she invited us in for tea, and it's. It's just a place that that's changed dramatically too. There's been a great effort. A lot of these nomads have now left that way of life and have moved to towns and cities. So a lot of that is now kind of over.
You've been often or several times in Tibet.
Yeah, I've been there maybe 5 times, yeah.
Yeah, I assume this is also from, or where is that?
Yeah, that's Tibet, too, yeah. The thing about, they have such great style and flair. This was a festival, but, you know, the particularly the women, they love makeup, they love jewelry, they like a big hat. But they do this on a daily basis, not just for, it's never for the tourists, it's just for their own pleasure. So it's amazing.
It's nice.
Yeah. 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 This is Yemen again. I was in Yemen, kind of between civil wars. This is, again, in 97 or so.
This is also amazing.
Oh yeah, I did
but
a book.
He still can read without glasses. I mean, you see that he underlined something.
Yeah. I've always loved. I was kind of inspired by André Kertész, the great Hungarian photographer, who did a book on reading back in 75, and I've also over the last 40 years photographed random people reading. And I did a book a couple years ago on people reading around the world. This was one of them.
Reading. There's one question I also wanted to ask you. What was your most important teaching lesson you learned in your life?
Well, I think the two things I learned, one was from Ernst Haus, a wonderful
photographer.
Yeah, he was Austrian.
Yeah.
He was a magnum photographer, a great color photographer, but
he was very modern in his art to photograph during his times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A really talented guy. Anyway, I did a workshop with him early in my career, and he really stressed the idea of learning the history of photography and looking at pictures, other people's pictures, great photography, because you can learn so much from... And, you know, I mean, I think there's no better teacher than somebody like Ernst Haus or Henri Cartier-Bresson or Elliot Erwitt, and to look at their pictures and to really try and understand, you know, what is it about this picture which is so great? The light, the composition, the story, what is it? And to try and analyze it and then kind of incorporate some of those lessons into your own work. That was one lesson I learned. The other lesson, which I never took the advice, but one of the reasons I was very interested in Magnum Photos was because Henri Cartier-Bresson was one of the founders. And so I applied, I got into Magnum, and I started to try and spend time with Henri and Martine, his wife. And so I would go to their house, and I'd show him a book that I had done. And one day over lunch, he said, look, for your commercial work, it doesn't matter. Shoot in color, it doesn't matter. But he said, for your personal work, just shoot in black and white.
That's what he said.
That's what he told me. I thought, oh, my God, here's my idol, you know, the guy that I've kind of, you know, looked up to, and here I'm going to ignore his advice because, you know. But I decided early on that since the world is in color, and in so many places I've worked and traveled to, color is integral to that story. You know, I think of a Tibetan monastery, the kind of all the color, and whether it's a Hindu priest or Tibetan monk or festivals, color often is really again a part of the story. So you can't ignore that, and it's best to tell.
No, especially, I mean, in India. Sorry, but this is one of the colorful countries you can see. And one photographer once said to me that shooting in black and white is much easier than in color.
Oh yeah, that debate. You know, it's first of all, I think that a lot of my very close photographer friends, Sebastio and Nakwe, different people, shooting black and white. I think it's great. I think you should photograph however you want to, digital film. If you want to use a pinhole camera or a, you know, a plastic camera, I mean, there's no... But with color, you have composition, there's the light, shapes, and, you know, the harmony and rhythm. But you have that problem, that extra problem to solve, which is color. And if there's a beautiful picture, but there's the color is off, it can kind of spoil the whole presentation. So color is infinitely more difficult. Whenever I get a black and white of some, I think, oh, that's great. I don't have to worry about the color. I can just
You can contrast more or less, but that's it. You don't have to work on the color, right?
Yeah. But again, I mean, I have the utmost respect for...
It depends on the topic. I mean, we will come later on also to some rare black and white photos from you in this presentation. Mm-hmm. So what is going on there?
Oh, this was the they were taking the Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister, had been assassinated, and they're taking her body down to be cremated. And these were some of her devotees kind of mourning and shouting out praise for her. Oh, this is in northern Afghanistan, Mazar Sharif. This man and his wife had made a pilgrimage to this particular shrine. And it's really taboo to photograph women in Afghanistan. So I was a little I was a little bit nervous that the man would come over and say, you know, you're photographing my wife.
But this is also a question. I mean, you really have, like, we have the exhibition in the Leica Gallery, and there are only portraits and very close portraits. How normally the people react? I mean, this is, you open your soul in a way when you get so close to someone.
Well, all the people all my portraits are all done and with their permission. It's a collaboration. Because of that intimacy and that eye contact, I mean, you have to have their cooperation. So I'm always very careful. I mean, if people don't want to be photographed, I'm totally fine with that. I never force anybody.
But that means you ask them?
All the time.
That's important.
Now, in this case, I didn't, because it would mean, you know, I thought it was another picture. But no, if I'm in a portrait situation, I always ask them and explain what I'm doing, and then I proceed. And as I said, if they don't want to do it, then that's fine. I never force anybody.
And they don't want to see what you shoot later on. Well, sometimes you let them, of course, nowadays possible, but during the film time, it wasn't possible.
Yeah, no, it was it was impossible. With digital, I'm happy to... I generally try to discourage that, because it ends up taking a lot of time, and then their friends come, and pretty soon it you know, everybody's looking and all that. It gets I try to avoid that. But I find most people, you know, 9 times out of 10 people are willing to be photographed. And again, if you have to assume and understand that not everybody wants to be photographed, and that's fine. So you just move on.
But this is always, I think, a conversation between the photographer, and when you do a portrait, it's both sides do a step forward to each other.
Sure.
And that means get in a deeper connection.
Right. Yeah, I don't think there is any benefit to push that and to try and... I think, you know, I'll try and convince somebody that this is going to be, you know, this, you know. But there's a point when you just have to kind of let it go. But that's never been an issue with me. Most people are very willing and flattered and happy to be photographed.
And can you say that this changed during the last years? Because, you know, of taking care, I don't want to be shown, blah, blah, blah. Street photography nowadays is not so easy as it was.
Yeah, I think where I work, most of the time where I work, it's okay. I know that in some countries it's become very difficult to photograph on the street, but I generally don't photograph in those countries. I don't know.
So this is Afghanistan?
That's me. With
you in Afghanistan now.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
You recognize him?
I haven't really covered an area of conflict for, I would say, 25 years, because I did that. I thought it was important at the time, but I kind of now want to do something else. And I've moved on to other things.
So there we are with the black and white. I have to say that I never saw before. I saw these pictures, black and white pictures from you.
Right.
Why did you decide then to have, I mean, we will see another couple of black and white pictures. Why did you decide to shoot this in black and white?
Well, at that time, I didn't really have any more, I had very few rolls of color. So in order to keep working, I had to buy some film, and the black and white was more available than the color. And so I decided, and plus I could process it locally, so I decided just to go with what I could.
So that means you traveled with these soldiers?
Yeah.
For how long?
On this trip, it was 2 weeks. I had been there previously another week, but I made about 30 trips into Afghanistan. 30. And spent months and months and months.
And what was your experience in just in a short sentence about the Afghanistan war? I mean, if you look at this picture, it's unbelievable. With a gun, praying.
Yeah, in the beginning it was, you know, their country had was being invaded by the Soviet Union. There was a kind of very clear-cut sort of, you know, reason and whatnot. As time went on, it became much more politicized, and foreign countries got involved. India, Pakistan, Iran, the U.S., China. It got kind of very messy, and then it progressively became even more messy until today. It's just the situation keeps evolving, and we're only maybe in the middle of the story. We're not even towards the end.
So this is also amazing, yeah.
Yeah.
This is fun.
You know, I like this picture particularly because they had just made this rope out of the hair of like goat's hair, and we're about 3 days walk from civilization. 3 days walk. And they just made this rope, and they're swinging on this rope over rocks. And I thought to myself, if that rope breaks, you could either be seriously injured or killed or whatever. But Afghans
they were not thinking about that.
Just test this rope. And I thought, oh my God, you know.
This is also amazing, this picture.
Well, this is one of those cases where, the whole
old and new world.
Yeah. They're covered. I remember in Afghanistan, they said, well, sometimes cameras can see through the clothing of a woman. You know, they have these kind of, because they have these wild sort of myths that they, you know. But I saw these women in the shoe shop, and I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. I'm going to, even though I haven't walked up to each woman and said, you know, can I have your permission? You know, there's a limit to how much you can. And if you look at the history of photography from like day one, there's people have been photographing the world, just capturing moments of our human history. And you simply can't ask each and every person in the picture for, it's just, you know. But I just decided that.
So, but they were standing like this, or they just turned around?
No. They were shopping for shoes.
Yeah.
And, this was their, they were on their way to Kabul to part of the invasion force.
And you never had any bad experience during the Afghanistan war?
No. I was in lots of sort of places where we were bombed. We got bombed many times. But the worst experience of my life when I came so close to dying was actually in Slovenia, in a very touristic place. It's called Lake Bled, outside of Ljubljana. And I was in a plane crash, and I thought, you know, this is
a plane crash.
Yeah, I was in a two-seater, and it crashed into Lake Bled in February, and I found myself upside down, couldn't breathe. There was an open cockpit, and couldn't breathe. I couldn't see. It's really cold, and I couldn't get the seatbelt off, And I thought, I'm going to die. Because I couldn't breathe. I mean, I was underwater. And unfortunately, I was able to crawl out. But so Afghanistan was easy compared
not
to
not in
that.
Afghanistan, but it's Slovenia. This is, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, this is northern Afghanistan.
Blue impression. Wonderful. So different kinds of blue.
I've always loved people sleeping, whether it's on a park bench or, you know, that's one of the themes that I've followed in my career. People reading, people sleeping.
And family, eating.
Eating, yeah, eating.
And, at a family table.
Couples on park benches. I have a lot of pictures in Madrid of lovers on park benches in that park nearby. I'll do a book on couples on park benches one day.
I just go in between a little bit further because we, of course, also will come to the Afghanistan girl.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also very nice here. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a different kind of look at a little girl in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not all, you know, war and you know, in a lot of the villages, people are living a very normal life. So, taxi driver and his dog after.
Amazing.
This is about child labor. A boy's probably was like about 11 or 12 years old, and he was going to this candy factory at 5 o'clock in the morning, not going to school, and then working until 3 o'clock in the afternoon every day. And it kind of, in a way, kind of breaks your heart because he's not having a normal childhood. He's working. He's not playing with his friends. He's not learning anything. It's kind of sad, you know.
The whole family on one.
Yeah, the whole family. Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable that you always find this very, very special situations. I mean, this is only possible if you really travel with the people.
Yeah.
And without you always travel on your own.
Well, I always travel
mainly.
I travel with a guide or a translator because you have to be with somebody who can help you get along, get around, and also if there's a problem, he or she can solve the problem. Especially in a place like Afghanistan, where you know there's cultural questions that you need to be sensitive to, and also there's a lot of banditry and kidnapping and all that. So you want to make sure you're not in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. So this is interesting, juggling.
Yeah,
Is this the school or what is it?
Yeah, it was a school for... It was a young people learning to perform for other children. So it's kind of a...
So like a circus in a way,
a little bit.
It's
like a circus, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he looks sad. Contrary to him.
Yeah.
So, this is the one not so known, this picture. Was that shot before the known one?
Yeah, that was just maybe a minute.
Before
the other one.
That one.
Before that one, yes. Same place, same time, just slight adjustment.
Do you know the story? I mean, of course, a lot of stories are told and still vivid about this picture, but the most important story is what happened after this picture. When did you decide to look for this woman again? How many years passed in between that you decided, I would like to meet this woman in between again?
Well, it was 17 years. It was in.
And why was it? Why did you decide? I mean, you have a lot of pictures. Why you decided to look for her?
Well, it was just after 9/11. As we started to understand what happened, we understood that Afghanistan was part of this story. And as the attention of the world really focused on Afghanistan, people started asking, like, you know, who is this girl? Where, you know, and so I decided, along with the filmmaker, to go back to try and find her, to find out what happened to her and her story. And so, just by like sheer luck and
how did you really find her?
Well, because we went back to the same refugee camp where I had originally.
How many years were in between?
17.
17.
17. Yeah.
Oof.
And we got very lucky. We found a teacher that was in the school.
So you went with a photo and asked,
yeah,
around, did you?
That's right.
Yeah.
The picture was really the key. Eventually there was a man who told us that he knew where her brother was living. And as soon as we found the brother, then we found her. And so she made a journey from inside Afghanistan and came to meet us. And from there we photographed her again.
But you said, when I remember well, you said that when you found her after these 70 years, her eyes has totally changed.
Well, there were two things about that. One was that now she was 30, more or less. Afghans never really know their exact birthday.
Mm.
They have an
appraisal.
Yeah. And the other thing was that the light on her, this was morning, this was indirect morning light, 11 o'clock in the morning. Very, yeah. So the light when I photographed the second time was late afternoon light. So it wasn't quite as strong. But I think the main reason was she's older. I mean, here she's like 12.
But you said these eyes were more curious to know more about life. And
well,
when you met her again, the eyes were more sad.
Well, I think that part of her expression could have been partly because she had never been photographed before. And two, you know, here's this strange man that doesn't speak her language. He's dressed in a different way. He has this funny camera. And I think she was just very curious about, you know, me and what am I doing there, because this was something unusual. So, and again, probably she's there with her friends in the classroom, and their friends were running around and laughing and making, you know. So I think there was a bit of, they were just having a bit of fun that morning in the classroom.
Instead of later on when you met her?
Well, when I met her, you know, she, one of her daughters had died, and her husband had diabetes. And so, you know, this whole thing, he was making $1 a day working in a bakery. So I think the pressures of life, in addition to her being a refugee, an orphan, I think, you know, being a mother with all this responsibility and having a husband who wasn't living, he was in the town, she's living in the countryside. Mm-hmm. I think it was a lot of pressure. So I think that accumulation of all that probably was heavy, weighing on her. You know.
And just tell us just shortly about the foundation.
Oh.
And also what you did for her.
Well, after we found her, the magazine started sending her money every month for. She's now living. She's now more under the protection of the government in Afghanistan, in Kabul. But up until then, up until 3 years ago or so, we were sending, National Geographic was sending her money every month, and myself and my sister were sending her money every month. And then my sister took about $70,000 to meet with her and to buy her own home, her own house.
Because normally women are not allowed to own a house.
Right.
No.
So we never talked about it primarily because not only that culture, but any culture, I think if people start to understand that the neighbor, the relative, the friend is fabulously wealthy, and that wasn't the case, but people's imagination started to go crazy, that if you have so much wealth, why can't you share some of that with me? You know, what about me?
Then at the moment you have a lot of relatives.
Right. And so we decided at her request to try and be, to keep that a bit quiet.
But you founded a school there also?
There was a school for young Afghan girls, educate at the same age, kind of like somewhere between 12 and 15, just for girls to be, it was kind of more like vocational, sewing and cooking and whatnot. And they were given a hot meal in the course of the day. So we really, I think that it was a great benefit to her, and in addition
to
other girls.
Not only to her, yeah.
Yeah. And now and then she would say, oh, my brother's, needs to go to the hospital or whatever. So we were always helpful to her. So I wish I could do that to more people I photographed, but this was a very,
very specific and special story. And I think this is really important to hear, what can a picture do? Because when you see the picture, you don't know normally what is really behind and what was the development behind. Did you meet her again after you found her?
Well, I met her once, and I photographed her for the. And then my sister went back twice, actually three times, once to buy the house, another time just to...
So that means, but you are still in contact with your
sister.
Well,
what happened was, to make a long story short, she had a problem with her residency papers in Pakistan, and now she's living in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan, and more under the protection of the Afghan government. So now we've... So we're now a little bit out of the picture because there's other forces who are under, she's under their protection. And since we're not there to really, things are never easy in Afghanistan. She is still illiterate, and her life continues to be difficult.
Okay, in between I went on a little bit.
So oh, yeah.
This is really amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Just take it. Looks very easy.
Well, I was on the train one morning and...
There's a coffee and a croissant or something.
Yeah, yeah.
First class.
we'd had ordered some tea, and my assistant said, you're not going to believe this, but the door's locked, and they're passing our tray, all the trays, on the outside of the train. So I looked out, and oh my God, this is wild. So I had my assistant hold my legs, and I leaned out the window, and hoping he wouldn't let me go. Yeah, I was thinking, that most of my assistants, if they were in that situation, would have just let me fall out the window. That was our first morning together. He didn't get to know me that well. It's the Taj Mahal. That piece of land next to the Taj Mahal now is it's more of a protected area. This was a wheat field or rice field or something. But now there's no longer they don't cultivate that land anymore. So this is kind of a historical picture now.
Okay. Wow.
This is in Pakistan. I love this picture because it's so surreal. You have these huge ships that are pulled up on the beach, and then they cut it apart for scrap metal, and it's just so weird to have a...
This is a wonderful light situation.
Oh, this is another reading picture. But yeah, this is early in the morning at probably 6 a.m.
Oh, here, Steve.
Yeah.
In person.
Oh, that's, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's me.
This is also... So there's no space inside, and then we use the outside.
So as we travel across India, the train would stop at literally hundreds of stops along the way. You can imagine how many local stops there are. Mm. So every time the train would stop, my assistant would watch my luggage inside, and I would jump out and photograph while we were stopped. And then when the train started again, I would jump back on the train. So, you know, that we did
that. So that was just before the train started, obviously.
Well, these people are going to market, and in order to just to, they're kind of, you know, just to put their bicycle on the side of the train, and they will go back on their, you know. This is also a picture which will never be taken again because that track has been ripped out of the ground. And there's trees and everything there.
And this is,
this is near the Taj Mahal.
Mm-hmm. So this is also an iconic image.
That's Calcutta.
This is in the 80s, or when is it?
96. 1996.
Yeah, Calcutta. Okay, this is the very... Oh, this well-known is festival in India.
India. Yeah.
Yeah, the color ones.
Taj Mahal.
Yeah. So I go a little bit further on because time is running fast, and I would like to come to the Chinese new, brand new images never seen before with our wonderful new Leica SL, which we will launch. We launched it yesterday in Paris and today in Madrid. So this is also, of course, yeah. Sorry, I go a little bit. It's okay for you?
Sure.
Yeah?
I have no idea how many...
This is a wonderful one as well. I'm looking forward to that one. I mean, the only thing I can imagine he still has is his sewing machine, and he's laughing.
Well, let me tell you...
Unbelievable.
Let me explain that, because... So I'm on this street in this very small village in India, this foreigner with these cameras, and they saw me, and they saw this guy walking, and they started yelling to the guy, oh, this guy's going to take your picture. This foreigner is so better smile for the camera. Okay. So this guy with the sewing machine becomes very self-conscious and self-aware of the camera, so... He started to smile because, you know, and I like that. That's the story behind it.
He also smiles, but not so really. Steve. Andrea, you selected a lot of images. Sleeping again? Oh my God. This was in Tibet or where was it?
Tibetan monk, yeah.
Also, yeah. Meditation upside down, wasn't that?
Yeah. Japan. He was pissed off. He said, no photo.
You can see it in the in
before
his
he turned
eyes.
Around, I clicked the picture.
Oh,
this is
going to
take a while. This is going to, I don't know how many I'm not sure where, there could be hundreds of pictures. I don't know where the...
You again? Oh, it's a horror. 9/11. So that was by chance that you were in New York during
just,
that time?
Just,
because, I mean, normally you are not in New York.
Right, I just got back the night before.
The night before?
The night before, I was in Tibet. And I flew back. I don't know why they put these pictures in there, but...
Ask Andrea. This is the picture
this
we were talking about in the bus.
This is one of my best friends. We're like that, you know. We vacation together. He always calls me for advice.
Not your best friend, I suppose.
Yeah.
This is Mexico
border. This is Trump's...
Yeah.
This is Donald Trump's wall.
Yeah. So
okay.
There we are now.
Here we are.
So what was your experience with the new SL in China? That was 2 or 3 weeks ago?
It was back in, I think it was the end of August.
End of August.
Yeah. Or September or something. So I was really very impressed with the ease, the logic of the buttons and the controls and whatnot. I think that, and one of the things I've always hoped for was to be able to make really wonderful pictures in very low light, because I prefer kind of dark, moody situations. And I found this camera, it performs really wonderfully at very high ISO. The lenses are incredible. I mean, the detail is just unparalleled. So I think with the camera, you want to, the performance of this tool, it's had to do with reliability and then how well it, you know, the lens. It's, in the end, it really boils down to the lens. Now, if you want to put the camera, if you want to print your pictures out of focus, you can do that. But I prefer pictures very crisp. I like to make big enlargements. And I found with this camera, the SL2, it allows you to make large prints. So I want the capability to make the best print I can at... If I want to make a large size, I can do that with this camera. It's better than I've experienced in the past.
That's wonderful to hear. And I think this is a decisive moment there. Look at the tool.
Yeah.
Up in the air.
I mean, China's changed dramatically since when I went back, when I was there for the first time.
I just wonder, when did you visit China the first time?
It was 1984.
1984.
And everybody had those Mao suits,
yeah.
And there was no economy to speak of. And the transformation is beyond imagination, where China was then and where China is now. And then you can only imagine where it's going to be in another 20 years. It's just unbelievable. To look at Shanghai as an example, you know, there were these fields when I was there, and now it looks like some futuristic city.
And even they had some old towns, and they recognized when they built China, everything was damaged, and then in the middle of China, of Shanghai, they have a little space left with the old town.
Yeah, their approach is to let's modernize, let's have everything be new, and the old, some of the charm of the old place isn't their priority. But I look at China.
This is sad because they have an amazing cultural
story
behind.
Oh yeah. No, I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, and today, which is fascinating to me, is that the train in China, you know, the train to the plane in Shanghai, we don't have one high-speed train in the U.S., not even one.
No, you and have really...
No, our trains
I just, in January, I took the train from New York to Boston, and it was really not easy to go to the restroom because it was going like this, and I think they only have like 100 kilometers. They are not able to
It's very antiquated.
Drive faster.
Yeah. It's very antiquated, and there's, it's, you know, it's
so this
you know,
is the contrary limit.
This is making America great again.
So my really last question, then perhaps the audience has some question for Steve. My last question, perhaps you can answer it in two or three sentences. When you have one wish for the future for photography, what wish would that be?
Wow. Well, I think that, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to answer it, I suppose, but I think that we're seeing photography, picture making, becoming more and more accessible to everybody. I mean, literally, you know, when I was in Afghanistan, even 10 years ago, even the vegetable vendor on the side of the road had a cell phone. So, literally, almost anybody on the planet now can, and then most of these phones have a camera. So now we're in a position where literally everybody can photograph their friends, their family, birthdays, weddings, and have the potential to kind of document their own lives and their friends, which wasn't the case in the recent past. So I think that as picture making becomes more easier, it's a great way to have these memories to document our lives. Because what's more, you know, they always talk about if your house is on fire, what would you say first, apart from your cash and your safe? No, I'm joking. But you would say family pictures. I mean, what's more important than pictures of your family? So to... You know, to have this possibility to have this record of our family and friends, I think is so. So we're getting more and more to that point. So I think that having photography accessible to everybody is a great sort of goal that we can have.
My wish would be that if I look at the Afghanistan girl or at the Nick Ut image, that we have these pictures more in the future, that pictures, from my point of view, are still able to change opinions, to take care of really unbearable situations worldwide.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree.
So, thanks a lot. It took quite a long time. I think we don't have any time for questions. Sorry. But
maybe
if you have one really urgent question, so please go ahead. I don't see really quite well. So there's one lady in the back. Oh, okay. So we have three. Okay, one, two, three. Good. So perhaps you start. You have a microphone that everybody can hear you, or?
Empiezo yo, que tengo el micro.
I will start myself because I have the microphone.
Yes.
We can hear you, yes. I hope the rest as well.
Sorry. I know you've been around the world twice, but is there
I've been around the world dozens of times, actually, but that's okay.
Yeah, but I mean, is there a country you haven't been yet?
Or? There's two that I often refer to.
Hay dos que a los que hago mucha referencia, Madagascar, que voy a ir la semana que viene, y lo voy a tachar de la lista porque siempre he querido ir allí. Y el otro país al que siempre he querido ir es a Irán.
Because of the political problem between Iran and the U.S., it's become
complicated.
Very difficult. I have a permanent exhibition in a museum in Iran right now, and unfortunately I haven't been able to visit it. A good friend of mine, that Hussein Firmani, who runs the Lucy Foundation, has put up this exhibition. I think Iran is a fascinating country, wonderful people, you know, glorious past, but there's this political situation, and it's just a political hot potato. So one day, when I'm in a wheelchair, they'll let me come in.
You will be never on a wheelchair. So, okay. So I think here we had...
Hola, buenas tardes.
Hi, good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank you very much for this photograph. Everyone, I think, fell in love with her, and me too. I fell in love with her. But my question is, you were born as a photojournalist using a very simple technique, because we have the analog camera. Now, you are using a digital technique as a photographer, a technique that you can modify photographs and use Photoshop and so on. Do you feel nostalgia of that period as a photojournalist?
First of all, I have no nostalgia for film at all. Zero. I think that digital photography has opened up new possibilities which never existed before. So, as far as my career working for magazine and newspapers, I think it's important to reinvent yourself and to grow and to change. Now at my age, I prefer to work for me. You know, I spent years and years working for editors and magazines, deadlines, do this, do that, here's a list, go here, do that. And I want to photograph what personally interests me in my own time, in my own way. I want to be able to go to a place like Havana and just wander the streets. And just whatever catches my eye, whatever I'm fascinated with, whatever, I'm not worrying about, oh, I have to get this, I have to get that, and I have to have a certain agenda, you know, kind of serve an agenda for a magazine, because they have certain expectations. So I want to do it in my own way, photograph the place with respect and all of that, but not have to answer to anybody but me. And I want to be able to relax and not have to worry about, you know, rushing back for a deadline, or they told me to get these six things and I have to check those off. I don't have to do that. I did that for decades, and now I just want to, with the brief amount of time I have left in this planet, I want to just work for me, if that makes sense.
But he is so fit, really. When I think about he's doing during the next two weeks, it's unbelievable.
People say, "Are you retired? Are you still taking pictures?" It's like, wait a minute, I'm working now more than I ever have, and I'm getting more fulfillment. Because when I was in Cuba, I went with my wife and my daughter. And, you know, I'd come back for lunch. We'd have a nice lunch. And if I wanted to start late, no problem. If I wanted to come back early, if I wanted to go shopping. So if I was working for a magazine, can you imagine a magazine saying, oh, yeah, take your wife and child. We'll pay for that and just roam around and do whatever you want. So, now I'm in the position where I can go there on my own expense and just do it in my own way.
Okay, the last question for... Oh, yeah, there.
Hi.
Here, hello.
We have one.
Here?
I can't see it. Okay, sorry.
Hi. So, my name is David. Thank you, Steve, for your time. And I just wanted to ask you, those photographs you do that ironically don't see the light, what do you use them for? What uses you think they have, and how do you choose them, and how do you choose what to share and what not to share? Thank you.
Sure. Well, as photographers, we all make thousands of pictures, and I think in the end you, just because you made the, there's a process. When I go out in the morning, sometimes I need to kind of prime the well. I need to start to shoot just to get the wheels moving. So they're literally, I think Henri Cartier-Bresson said, if in your career you can make a few hundred great pictures, that's, you know, he'd be satisfied. The other pictures sit in the archive. You look at pictures differently. Pictures I made in the 70s or the 80s, now you look back and some of them have value that you didn't recognize then. So I don't throw anything away. And some of the pictures which seemed to be useless 20 or 30 years ago now suddenly take on a significance for historical reasons. So, just because I have a million transparencies doesn't mean I have to use them all. They're sitting in my sort of vault, and I go back from time to time and look at them. Again, sometimes pictures work better. If I'm doing a story on a book on reading or people sleeping, I can go back to the archive and find pictures which may not be great by themselves, but as part of a collection, they kind of work in the group. So I go back to the archive all the time, and most of the archive will never see the light of day, but it's okay. I mean, that's just the way the photography works.
So, Steve, thank you again. Thank you for your time.
Yes.
Hasta aquí nuestro episodio de hoy. Nos escuchamos en el próximo y nos leemos en las redes sociales del Espacio y de la Fundación.
Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica, producido por Cuanda.